So now I'll hand over to Tom to introduce the talk. This session, just to make sure you're all in the right place, is Are the USA and Australia Headed for War with China? And this is going to be introduced by Tom Bramble. Tom Bramble is a long-term member of Socialist Alternative. He's a member of our national executive, and he's also an author. He's written the Introducing Marxism book, as well as this rather excellent book on the trade unions in Australia, and he's a regular contributor to Red Flag and the Marxist Left Review, including in the current edition. He's written an article on the state of the trade unions in Australia today, and there's also this issue number 3 of the Marxist Left Review, where he has written about Australian imperialism and the rise of China. And so with that, well, yeah, and this is also available. You'll see people around. There's someone just outside the door selling the Marxist Left Review. There's actually a special at the moment where you can get a 2-year subscription for $50 and the back issue of your choice. So I'd really encourage you to have a look out there for the Marxist Left Review seller. And on that, I'll hand over to Tom to introduce the talk.
Morning, comrades. Okay, I think it's no exaggeration to say that the most significant feature of world politics today is the growing geostrategic competition between the United States and China. This is evident in the massive growth of US and Chinese military budgets. It's also evident in the sharpening economic conflict between the two sides and increasing nationalist rhetoric emanating from both governments. Australia, of course, is keen to get involved on America's side. In fact, there wouldn't be many prime ministers or presidents in the world today more loyal and more uncritical of Donald Trump than our own Malcolm Turnbull. Now, I'm going to start not by talking about, numbers of battleships of each side. I'm going to start by trying to lay out a basic framework for understanding this emerging competition. Here I'm hoping many of you attended Ben Hillier's session on Friday morning on Nikolai Bukharin and the Economics of War, which provided a great theoretical basis for understanding the world system today. Ben's talk was focused very much on the time that Bukharin wrote his book in the context of World War I. Essentially, what I'm going to do today is take Bukharin's framework and try to use it as a way of explaining the competition between the United States and China, indeed, the general shape of the world imperialist system in 2018. So because Ben gave such a great introduction, because the book is very available at our bookshop over the road, I'm only going to give you a brief summary of the basic Marxist argument of imperialism here, and we'll refer you on to other sources if you want to go into it in more depth. So the starting point is that the capitalist system is a social order wracked by a contradiction between the forces of production, which are constantly pushing toward the global division of labour and global economy, and the social relations of production characterised by competition between national capitalists over the value created by the working class. Competition in the capitalist system takes place in two ways. First and foremost, between the capitalist classes and the working class, in other words, class struggle, and second, through competition between the capitalists for domination over markets. The capitalists unite in their determination to squeeze the working class to appropriate more surplus for themselves, but are divided in their own ranks as each tries to appropriate a greater share of the surplus produced by the working class that they collectively exploit. The competition between the capitalists for greater share of the surplus produced by workers takes place initially within local and regional markets, and increasingly national, international, and even global markets. As the level of competition ratchets up, two further processes take place. First, monopolisation, in other words, the enlargement of each block of capital as the big destroy the small. And second, fusion of capital with the state, as the state acts as the best guarantor of the interests of the capitalist classes in their international markets. In particular, as the capitalist system matures, that state backing of national capitalists increasingly takes the form of military reinforcement of their interests, breaking into or defending markets and breaking down the barriers to trade for each national group of capitalists. So you have a string of things coming together. Competition on an ever-widening sphere, monopolisation of capital, increasing state intervention and its fusion with capital, and attempted increasing militarization of relations between states. In other words, Bukharin argued that the tendency in modern world economy, therefore, is to war. Now, some countries race ahead of others as they seize foreign territories for new markets, sources of raw materials and labor power, and so forth. They move ahead of others. They establish empires. Those that did so were at an advantage over those that had not, the later arrivals. And so competition between established powers and emerging powers for domination of the world system, Bukharin wrote, is a feature of modern capitalism. Hence World War I, the period he was writing, and hence World War II and the Cold War, which emerged decades later. Now, one feature that becomes obvious in the 20th century is that war increasingly becomes total war, as resources of each national state are thrown behind the war effort. Whatever the expense, when it comes to a period of imperialist competition on the world scene, each imperialist or block of imperialists has to defeat its rivals. Dollar accounting, that is this war going to benefit me and my bottom line, is left behind now as the battle becomes one of sheer survival as an imperialist player. To lag behind is to be destroyed. Now, Bukharin's work, I think, explains very well the emergence of both the world wars and the Cold War that emerged afterwards. Now, to cut a very long historical period short, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 ushered in an unusual period of unipolarity, with the United States unchallenged superpower. But that could not be sustained forever. The defining feature of the first two decades of the current century has been the rapid rise of China up the imperialist league table and the efforts by the United States to hold it back. Now, on top of these developments in world economy and world imperialism, we also have to understand that as capitalism ages, it becomes more crisis-prone. Booms become shallower and shorter, busts deeper and longer, other things remaining the same. So, the competition between nation-states that leads at times to war takes place in the context of a world system increasingly racked by economic crises. These crises only intensify the competitive process. The pie is no longer growing, and each capitalist expense must come at the expense of another. Each capitalist gain must come at the expense of another. And further, as the crisis bites, the capitalists are forced to attack the working class more viciously to try to restore their profit margins. That pretty much sums up the state of the world system today. A world of dog-eat-dog competition between the major powers for domination of world markets, in which competition is increasingly expressed in military terms, and in which the profits were once easy to come by are now harder to get, meaning each power is willing to take on more risk to get one over its rivals. All the while, the working class, which produces all the wealth in society, is under continuous assault by the capitalists and their governments as they seek to squeeze out more profits. Okay, so what does this mean for the world system today? The starting point is to understand the relative decline of the United States empire since the turn of the century. The United States failed most significantly in its attempt to boost its power through the War on Terror, which is an attempt to use the one area of imperialist competition, military power, in which it had an unvouched or an unchallenged military supremacy to promote the interests of American capitalism more broadly. The War on Terror, from the perspective of American imperialism, and this is now recognised by all sensible American imperialists, will actually turn out to be a disaster, running to ground in the fields of Iraq and Afghanistan. Rather than demonstrating American strength, the War on Terror has only demonstrated and exposed its weakness. The United States is also left flat-footed by the Arab revolutions of 2011, things they had not predicted and basically had to chase after the course of events. Iran, one of George Bush's members of the Axis of Evil, has been probably the main beneficiary of American failures, most obviously in Iraq. Iran has done the most to capitalise furthermore on the disarray in the Arab world following the uprisings of 2011. In this context, with the US authority weakened in the region, Iran arising as a regional power, not just in Iraq but Syria too, some of America's most loyal allies, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, are now forging a more independent path, undermining the US ability, if you like, to pull the strings to manipulate the Middle East. Russia, too, after a period of retrenchment in the 1990s, is emerging once again as a regional power, most obviously in Central Asia, but also dipping its foot into Syria with Russian air power, and its economy now recovering on the basis of the oil boom of recent years. And of course, it still retains as many nuclear weapons as the United States. So a power now recognised by the United States as a second-order challenger to American hegemony. Even when it comes to little North Korea, the Pyongyang regime now looks set to eventually develop the capacity to launch a nuclear warhead at the United States. So all these are indicators of the weakening of the lead that the United States once exercised over the world system. Now, while the US has been stumbling from one disaster to another, China has been growing apace and is now emerging as a threat to US domination in the Asia-Pacific and beyond. The military balance between the two imperialist powers, once enormous, has shifted quite dramatically. In the year 2000, the United States spent nearly 10 times as much on its military as to China. In 2016, the imbalance was only 2.5 times as much. The United States is not just losing its military edge, even though it still undoubtedly leads, but the gap between it and China is narrowing, but also losing its economic edge over China as well. Since the year 2000, the US share of world GDP has fallen from 31% to 24%, while China's share has grown from less than 4% to 15%, and within a decade, it's widely predicted to overtake the United States. China is now leveraging these economic resources into geostrategic power for its Belt and Road Initiative to secure its challenge and eventually hope for domination over the Eurasian landmass, at least from Germany eastwards. Little wonder then that in its recent National Defence Strategy published in January, the Pentagon warned that China, quote, threatens to displace the United States and achieve global preeminence in the future. Something to keep the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department awake at night. The National Defence Strategy said that long-term strategic competition between hostile powers, what Marxists would call imperialist competition, is therefore back in the front page news. Dealing with the threat from China is now the primary goal of US military strategy. Tub-thumping about international terrorism and jihadi blowback and whatever is a distraction now from an essential task. In second place comes the rising threat, in US perspective, of Russia. And in third place, according to the National Defence Strategy, putting so-called rogue regimes, Iran and North Korea, back in the box. Now, these priorities are not just a result of some mad Trump Twitter feed. They are actually the priorities of the US ruling class as represented through the documents published by the Pentagon, the State Department, and so forth. Now, US pushback to these tendencies takes two forms, military and economic. First of all, as the United States publishes its national security strategy in December and its national defense strategy in January, we see accompanying this a massive expansion of the US military budget. In fact, even more generous to the Pentagon than Trump himself proposed. Congress actually overrode Trump's bill and added a few more tens of billions of dollars to American military spending. The idea is basically, once again, like with the war on terror, to use American military power to demonstrate its preparedness to wage war and to annihilate the country's enemies. To put into sharp reverse the cuts to military spending under the Obama period and to expand the military on all fronts, most especially nuclear weapons. Now, Australia, I'm hoping nobody here is surprised, is keen to jump on board this American military expansion. In fact, its decision to do so well predates the advent of Trump. Its 2016 Defence White Paper, following on from Gillard's 2013 Defence White Paper, spell out $200 billion expansion on Australian military spending over the next 10 years. Australia is now much more directly engaged in American war preparations in the Asia-Pacific. Its most important contribution to US military remains Pine Gap and other spy bases in Western Australia, but these provide important and critical information to the US war-making capacity. But alongside these has been the opening up of US Marines base in Darwin, the expansion of US Air Force operations in the Northern Territory, and increased visiting rights to the US Navy in Western Australia. Now, on top of these military initiatives, there is a recognition by Trump, and indeed by broader sections of the US establishment, that the method used to try and contain China's economic rise, or maybe put it another way, to shape China's economic rise in such a way that it was not a threat to the US, and that involved essentially inviting China to join the World Trade Organization in 2000, but very much in America's terms, that attempt to try and shape and guide China's economic rise in a way that's not disruptive to the United States has signally failed. That China's continued to rise strongly, and far from becoming integrated into what the Americans like to call the international liberal order, in other words, US domination of the world, is very clearly now a threat to US economic interests. This is what lies behind Trump's Make America Great Again strategy. If you like, it's the rational kernel of the outer madness. This rational kernel is one strategy, obviously not uncontroversial, within the US establishment and ruling class more generally, towards adapting to and confronting America's relative economic decline relative to that of China. And so the America First strategy involves such things as sabotaging the operations of the World Trade Organization, cutting funding to the United Nations, withdrawing from the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Paris Climate Accord, renegotiating NAFTA, and, more controversially, in the past 3 months, citing, very interestingly, national security grounds, a whole suite of new tariffs on everything from washing machines and solar panels to steel and aluminium, now, most recently, to a wide variety of Chinese industrial products worth up to $60 billion. Alongside these economic measures has been the appointment of a string of economic nationalists and military hawks to positions in the State Department, the economic advisers, national security advisers, the head of the CIA, a veritable war cabinet. Now, as I hinted at, there is some opposition in important areas of the American ruling class to tearing up the international trading system from which American multinationals benefited so strongly in the 1990s and 2000s. Big business has invested billions in international supply chains, much of which involves the Chinese economy. Little wonder, then, that Wall Street slumps every time Trump announces new tariffs. And Wall Street and the State Department are also concerned that Trump's scattergun economic nationalist policies are burning good relations with traditional allies. It doesn't do the United States' reputation any good, for example, when its economic nationalist policies are burning up good relations with allies such as Japan and South Korea. Sorry. In other words, if these governments find their products are now locked out of US markets or hit with stiff tariffs. So there is something of a tension then, if you like, between Trump's Make America Great Again economic nationalism, the interests of US multinationals in maintaining open markets, investments, and their international supply chains, between these two elements of American imperialist strategy. But I think when you look at how the steel and aluminium tariffs announced in February have been reshaped since their first announcement, gives you a hint in the way that geostrategic factors keep coming in through the back door, even what are actually nominally economic measures. Trump's policies have been very much framed around the Chinese are eating our lunch, they've a massive, huge trade surplus for the United States, they're causing factory outflow, they're gobbling up our markets, whatever. But then when you look at the steel tariffs, actually, a whole range of some of the biggest exporters of steel to the United States have now been exempted from these tariffs. More and more, those tariffs are now affecting only a narrow range of countries, including, I think quite significantly, China. Now, contrary to the popular wisdom that China is a massive exporter of steel to the United States, China, in fact, only accounts for 3% of US steel imports, whereas some of the other big exporters, who are, you know, if anything, responsible for the flood of steel imports coming to the United States, like Canada, like Germany, like maybe Mexico, they are actually exempted from these tariffs. So the fact that those steel tariffs are increasingly being narrowly defined on America's geostrategic rivals, in particular China and Russia, tells you, I think, about the nature of this economic program. I think we also see the military element come to the fore in other areas of Trump's economic nationalism. So although there might be some controversy around things like steel tariffs in relation to sections of the US capitalist class that use steel imports, we also see unanimity, I think, behind some other measures that have, you like, both an economic but also very clearly a geostrategic purpose. First and foremost, those, I think, is protecting what the national security strategy calls the national security innovation base. That is, the huge areas of the American economy now, they're investigating things like artificial intelligence, a whole series of computing technology which are beyond my ken, which are very important now to the operations of the Pentagon, its missile systems and so forth. And so Trump is announcing, and the Pentagon is backing them, real limitations on China's ability to buy up companies in this area, to prevent the transfer of technology from US companies operating in China to the Chinese government, to Chinese state-owned enterprises. And so you see here, if you like, a coming together of the protection, if you like, of American capital, narrowly defined, and also the strategic interests of the American establishment, which are building up the US war machine and preventing China, if you like, from using US technology for its own military purposes. We see a reflection of this in Australia as well. There's some chatter about Chinese investment in farmland. But the real thing the Australian ruling class is concerned about is things like Chinese investment in telecommunications, satellite technology, and so on. And so in the last couple of years, you've seen the coalition government begin to crack down, right against the free trade rhetoric, on Chinese SOE state-owned enterprise investments in Australian telecommunications. The same reason, to, if you like, build up a great Australian firewall, try and prevent Chinese investment and buying up sensitive telecommunications, information systems, technology, for the purpose of retaining a military edge over China in preparation for a potential war down the track. Now, the rising imperialist tensions are fueling political authoritarianism and racism. We saw this very obviously with the War on Terror, which sparked off the dreadful anti-Muslim racism which we are still living with today. In Australia, you can see this quite explicitly when it comes to the promotion of anti-Chinese racism, which is becoming an increasing theme. And this is most explicit with a recent book by Clive Hamilton, a member of the Greens, called Silent Invasion, where it's detailed the various ways in which the Chinese, you might want to go under your chairs before you leave today in case there's a Chinese spy there, a way in which the Chinese are penetrating Australian intellectual life, political life, journalism, the academic world, and maybe even the public service and state security to burrow away and to steal Australia's secrets. I think you might as well call Clive Hamilton's book Silent Invasion Yellow Peril, because that's basically where it's heading. Now, of course, it takes two to tango. Imperialism is not just American Australia versus the world. The Chinese ruling class, representing a rising imperialist power, have now cast aside their earlier reluctance to impose themselves internationally. China, too, is boosting its military spending this year to $225 billion. It's very keen to push back against the American Navy in particular, which dominates the crucial sea lanes, which are so vital for Chinese economic success and trade. Hence the militarisation of the new islands created out of sandbanks, the construction of a whole new blue water fleet, along with new missile systems. And when you look at the Belt and Road Initiative, this massive exercise in investment and exports into the Eurasian landmass, this is as much a means to secure access to raw resources, minerals, raw materials in the event of the South China Sea being blockaded by the US and Australian navies, as it is an exercise in trying to dump excess capacity from the Chinese steel industry. So the Belt and Road Initiative, therefore, is also part of, China's long-term planning to ensure its economic security in the event of a blockade by hostile America. You also see this tendency towards increasing authoritarianism at home within China, most obviously under Xi Jinping, who's basically wiped out his opponents in the Chinese state bureaucracy, is now setting himself up to rule for life. But also the wider crackdown on NGOs of various kinds to smash any intellectual opposition within universities, to crack down on labour organisations, and to tighten to a frightening degree the repression in Xinjiang and Tibet. And more generally, Chinese nationalism has been boosted as part of Xi's programme to, if you like, make China great again. The government's mission, quite publicly, is to push China once again into the ranks of the world's great powers, to see the period since the Opium Wars as being a period of great national shame, and that China must once again reassert its authority on the world stage. And Xi Jinping has his own versions of Trump's baseball cap-wearing enthusiasts, the so-called Little Pinks, nationalists who swamp Chinese social media sites, threatening anyone who disrupts the glorification of the Communist Party and the Chinese motherland. So, eventually, after 20 minutes, to get to the question of the talk, are we heading for a war between the United States and Australia and China? So it might be easy then to start with the reasons why this prospect is unlikely. First and foremost is the continuing deterrent effect of mutually assured destruction. The fact that both Xi Jinping and Donald Trump both have big red buttons on their desks. Second, even short of all that war, the economic and financial disruption caused by a military conflict between the two would be extremely serious for capitalists and governments on both sides. The United States is still a major market for Chinese producers. Capitalists in the United States, for their part, do not want to see the breaking up of the international supply chains, including China, they've established over the last three decades. And while the American government would be crippled if Chinese investors refused to buy American bonds, so the resulting recession, if they did so, would harm Chinese capitalists with big investments in the US, and indeed any Chinese exporter dependent on the US as buyer of last resort. So far as Australia is concerned, the economic disruption involved in any war or military conflict between the two sides would be even greater, since China is now the number one export market for everything from coal and iron ore to international education. And China matters a lot more to Australia than Australia does to China. Okay, so is the title of the talk just a provocation to stimulate interest on a Sunday morning? No. Because imperialist wars do not break out because each major power wants one or can see some marginal economic benefit in doing so. They break out because of moves by each country's rival or rivals gives it the choice of fighting or accepting extinction as a big power, or at the very least being knocked down the global pecking order. The classic case of this is World War I. None of the major powers wanted to fight a European war over the carve-up in the Balkans. But a decision by Germany to back the Austro-Hungarian Empire's declaration of war against Serbia immediately drew in Russia, which is Serbia's backer. With Russia drawn in, Britain and France were also pulled into conflict as Russia's allies. So from a pistol shot in Sarajevo to the grand mobilisation of the German army and invasion of Belgium was just 5 weeks. At stake was not the future of tiny Bosnia, but who was to dominate Europe. China, as now the second largest industrial power in the world, was no longer prepared to accept subordination to Britain, which had now fallen to number three, while Britain was not prepared to allow Germany to dominate the continent, potentially allowing to block the Royal Navy in the English Channel. If that were to occur, the British Empire was as good as gone. In World War II, Britain did not give two hoots about Czechoslovakia, was happy to abandon it to Hitler. But Britain fought when Hitler marched into Poland. The same reason. The British ruling class realised that once Germany had finished carving up Europe, locking out Britain, it was soon turned to British Empire. Not to fight meant humiliation and loss of the biggest empire the world had ever seen. And so today, China's expansion within the world system is eating away at US interests in Africa and Latin America and elsewhere, but most particularly in East Asia and Pacific, the region responsible, let's remember, for the most rapid growth in the world economy in the past four decades. It now accounts for 30% of world GDP, higher than that of North America, higher than that of Europe, which both stand at 27%. American capitalism and the American state cannot allow the United States to be pushed into second place by China in this hub of the world economy. It would damage the US not just in Asia, but around the world. Every one of its allies, whether in Europe, the Middle East, or Latin America, will conclude that the US could no longer protect its interests and might look instead to China as its new patron, just as Australia did with the United States in 1942 after the fall of Singapore to the Japanese. And the same can be said in reverse. The Chinese capitalists and state are voracious consumers of imported raw materials and commodities, in particular oil. The more China expands its economy, the more aggressively it must take action to defend its ability to trade. China cannot allow the United States to use its navy to block oil shipments to China. Hence the militarization of the atolls and sandbanks in the South China Sea. But these settlements in turn must be defended, hence the building of its new navy. The more steps China takes to establish a presence in the Asia Pacific, the more it must build up its military to protect that presence. An analogy might be made with Japan and China in the 1930s. Having invaded Manchuria in 1931, Japan had no choice if it wanted to sustain its imperialist ambitions in Asia, but to probe deeper into China, massacring the Chinese and waging war as it went. And then there is the question of Taiwan. One of the subtexts of making China great again is absorbing Taiwan, bringing it back into the motherland from the perspective of the Chinese Communist Party. Its autonomous status is an affront to Chinese nationalism and the Communist Party, whose ideological positioning now puts nationalism front and centre, now that communism as unifying ideology has been dispensed with. But the United States cannot allow China to seize Taiwan. If it can do so, why should Singapore or Vietnam or the Philippines believe that the United States can protect them? In other words, neither the United States nor China can allow things to develop in the current way indefinitely. The United States will not accept second place, and nor eventually will China. A clash of some sort is inevitable, regardless of the economic costs that will be paid by both sides. I should also add that, given Australia's record of backing the United States in all its wars over the past century, we too will be thrown into the thick of this fight. I just want to take a temporary aside to explain why this is the case, that Australia is inevitably and inexorably involved in America's military competition with China. It's not because, as is commonly thought on the left, because Australian prime ministers are just lackeys, toadies to the United States, just looking for applause in Washington. Australia too is an imperialist power, with its own imperialist interests in the broader region. And our rulers see these imperialist interests as best being served by its alliance with the United States. These interests include dominating the economies of the South Pacific and Papua New Guinea, investments in the fast-growing Asian economies, and most importantly, ensuring the sea lanes to our north that carry Australian trade and investments and allow for the free flow of American military supplies are kept open from free from interference by rival nations, increasingly from their point of view from China. Furthermore, compared to the strategy that some advocate, that Australia should reject the US alliance and forge a more independent path as an independent imperialist state, the US alliance has real benefits to Australian ruling class. Australia shelters, as a result of the alliance, under US nuclear umbrella, and can therefore economise on military spending compared to a situation where it had to fend for itself with its own nuclear deterrent and a much enlarged navy. These factors ensure that if the United States sounds the call for war with China, Australia will rally to its side, no matter what the cost might be in the short term in lost iron ore and coal exports, no matter how much the vice chancellors might wring their hands as the Chinese students depart the campus. That the notion of total war and imperialist competition has to put aside such short-term economic consequences and focus on the broader picture, which is imperialist domination of the fastest-growing and biggest economy in the world. Now, one argument against any kind of impending battle between China and the United States is that China is a military pygmy compared to the United States and therefore will have every incentive to avoid a fight. It has one offshore base in Djibouti, compared to America's 800. It has very few allies in Asia, and all are second or third string economies. Whereas the United States has a string of allies, much more powerful, like Japan, South Korea, India, and Australia, and a whole range of other Asian countries, each with their own anxieties about China's expansion. China has one or two aircraft carriers, the United States has several dozen, along with a warm welcome at ports across the entire region. But, without diverting the talk into war games for too long, it's unlikely the clash between China and the United States will simply comprise two fleets of battleships firing each other until one sinks the other. Artificial intelligence, smart technologies of various kinds are extremely disruptive to this kind of military encounter. China is now in the process, in some areas, of leaping ahead of the United States in these fields. It invests far more, for example, in artificial intelligence than does the United States now. It is conceivable, therefore, that Chinese technology may have the capacity to jam US naval communications. If the US battle fleet cannot communicate with Washington and with each other, it will be easy prey for the now rapidly expanding Chinese Navy and Air Force. And then there are land-based missile systems. Any conflict is likely to take place much closer to China's shores than America's, and China is reputed to have missiles that can knock out US aircraft carriers. And then finally, there is the question of the Korean Peninsula. Who can doubt that, despite the tensions that do exist between China and North Korea, that in the event of a military conflict between China and the US, China will not be tempted to urge the North to attack the South and rain bombs down on Seoul? The point of all this discussion about the military balance between the two sides is twofold. First is that neither side may want a war, but the whole logic of developments is to push both sides towards one. China, as a weaker power, may in particular do its best to avoid a clash, but it is not inevitable now that it would lose such a fight. As such, there is every chance that when faced with the choice of do battle or surrender, China may well choose to do battle. Failure to do so would mean not just a stalemate with the United States, but, like Britain and Germany in the First and Second World Wars, the loss of any ambitions it might have of dominating the South China Sea and beyond. In other words, it would ensure China's subordination to the United States for years to come, an unacceptable price to pay for the Chinese Communist Party with its ambitions now set high. So, we face the prospect of a third major imperialist war. In this case, the centre of the conflict will be Asia-Pacific, with the United States and China the main protagonists. Like the first two, Australia will be one of the combatants. Now, even short of the catastrophic losses that such a war would entail, financial and in human life, the current preparations for just such a conflict are impoverishing us today. So even though it's not like I'm predicting a war next year, 1 year, 2 years, or 5 years, the preparations for conflict between the two sides are actually already costing the working class of Australia, where money has been ripped out of social spending to pay for the extra $200 billion that's been pumped into Australian military. We are already paying the price for war in cold hard cash. Now, there are a series of demands that socialists can put forward to reduce the risk of such a clash between Australia and China. In particular, and the United States. In particular, that Australia should break from the US alliance. That involves shutting down Pine Gap, pulling out of Five Eyes intelligence sharing system, opposing visits by US warships and the garrisoning of US Marines, opposing every diplomatic manoeuvre to strengthen US influence in the Asia Pacific. All these measures will weaken the US abilities to, US's ability to wage war. But that is not just simply a fight against Washington. It's a fight against our own ruling class, which is committed to American power, as is the White House. That means battling against and fighting against, opposing the hundreds of billions of dollars now being ripped out of our pockets to pay for the war machine. Beyond that, it means fight with a whole capitalist system. I started by pointing out that in a system of competing national that the internationalization of the system and a system of competing national capitalists drives the rival imperialists into military conflict with each other. Furthermore, the crisis-ridden nature of the world economy drives the ruling class again and again to attack the working class. Wars and crisis are therefore the inevitable result of a social system based on private property. If we eliminated the capitalist class and with that the need for national borders, we could advance the productive forces on a global basis without this process constantly threatening the world with new wars. Socialism would break the fetters that constrain that potential for productive growth while eliminating the horrendous waste associated with military expenditure by socialising production, tearing down national borders, and eliminating the parasitic capitalist class. That's the ambition of Socialist Alternative, the organisers of this conference, to fight for a world where the threat of war is something relegated to the history books, not something that holds its terrifying power over the heads of billions of innocent civilians today.